This says February 24 at the top. I think it's March 24, but no worries.
Yeah, that's my bad.
No worries.
I fixed, okay. I fixed it in the clerk's office.
Okay. This is the March 24, March 2022 meeting of the Tucson Supplemental Retirement System Board of Trustees. Art, would you please call the roll?
Sure. Mark?
Here.
Kevin?
Here.
Jim?
Here.
Jorge?
Here.
Jeff Whiting?
Here.
Elsa? Vivian? Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum that Vivian and Elsa are not present at the start of the meeting.
There is some background noise. I'm not sure where that's from, but if whoever's got that going on can keep it down, we'd appreciate it. It's a bit distracting. First item on the agenda is the consent agenda. Do I have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved. This is Jorge.
I'll second. This is Jeff.
All right. Any discussion? Art, would you call the vote, please?
Sure. Mark?
Aye.
Kevin?
Aye.
Jim?
Aye.
Jorge?
Aye.
Jeff?
Aye.
Elsa?
Aye.
And Vivian is not present. Motion passes 6-0.
All right. Hold on one second. I have managed to screw up what I'm seeing on my screen. There we go. Okay. All right. We're on to administrative discussions. First item is the funding policy review.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. This is a follow-up from our continued conversation from really October and then more recently in January when we started the conversation with the special sessions. As you will recall, we heard from Mike last month, and I placed this on the agenda to have the board take action or not take action on the recommendations put forth by GRS. As a reminder, those three recommendations are to close the amortization period, to shorten the amortization period from 20 to 15 years, and to reduce our discount rate from 7 to 6.75%. I don't have any prepared materials for you. There wasn't anything new that GRS presented this month. And this is really just a follow-up from the past two or three meetings to see what the will of the board is as it relates to this item.
Thanks, Art. We've discussed this issue now. October, we had two special meetings plus January, February, so four or five times. I guess my question before we start any discussion is, does anybody feel like we need to continue discussing, or are folks ready to vote yay or nay? And again, I'm not trying to cut off any discussion, but I don't want to have a discussion just for the sake of feeling like we need to talk some more.
This is Jim. I'm ready to vote.
Okay.
This is Jorge. I'm ready to vote as well.
All right. Anybody feel like we need to have any more discussion? Okay. Art, or actually this question is really for you, Dana. My sense is that these three parts of the proposal work hand in glove. Is that a fair statement, or could we adopt one or more of them and not all of them?
You can absolutely adopt
you know, one or two or three. And just one clarification on the things that Art mentioned just now. The recommendation for the closing the amortization, our recommendation would be to do closed amortization, but layered amortization, which I think you can kind of think of as like semi-closed, right? So closing any unfunded liabilities we have right now, new experience gets a new 15 or 20 years. So again, just to reiterate, I think the most important part, the biggest recommendation is to close the amortization. So do closed layered amortization. So that would be the first aspect you're considering. And then the other two are certainly desirable, but not as important. Again, to move from the 7 to the 6.75, I think it's highly probable that the experience study next year will push us that direction anyway. And then, you know, the 20 years would be nice, but it's not a must do. So, I mean, you could close in 6.75. You could close in 15. That wouldn't necessarily be my recommendation because of the upcoming experience study may push you to that 6.75 anyway. So if you aren't wanting all three, you might end up with all three if you do closed in 15. Not to overwhelm you, but most important, closed. So I don't know if you want to do it as sort of a, you know, like a one at a time kind of thing rather than just put forth a motion with this and this or how you want to do it. But I really hope that we walk away from today with a closed amortization. You know, if it's a 20-year amortization, that's okay. But I strongly recommend the closed layered amortization. So.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
go ahead, Art.
If I could chime in as well. For the record, I would really prefer if we took three different action on this for clarity. So three different motions, and we can vote on them separately since they're, as Dana alluded to, they're distinct.
That's why I posed the question. It's clear from the answer and from your observations as well that we need to do three separate motions. So what I'd like to do is address first closed layered amortization, secondly the discount rate, and third the duration. If anybody's got major heartburn over that, speak up. But if not, I'd like to hear a motion regarding the closed layered amortization.
I move that we adopt a closed layered amortization schedule for going forward.
Okay. Let me pose, Art, the second and third parts of this process are relatively easy to describe. Do we have clarity about what closed layered amortization means? Or do we have a proposal that we can tether this to something that was put before us in the past few months?
Yeah, I think closed layered amortization is a pretty common industry practice, and I think that is probably sufficient description. And I would maybe add to the motion just for clarity, effective with the July 1, 2022 valuation.
Okay, Jim, are you okay with that addition?
Yeah, I'm okay with that, Mark.
All right. I don't think we heard a second, but I'm not sure. Did we get a second?
No, Mr. Chairman, second. We did not.
Okay. Did you catch that, Art?
Yes, I did.
Good. Okay. Do we want any discussion? No, anybody have anything to say about this issue? Or are we ready to vote? Sounds like we're ready to vote. Art, would you call the vote, please?
Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Jim.
Aye.
Jeff.
Aye.
Jorge.
Aye.
Elsa.
Aye.
Motion passes 6-0.
Thank you. Okay, let's take up the discount rate next. And I assume, Dana, that the concept would be this would also take effect as of July 1, 2022?
Yes, correct.
Okay, all right. Do we have a motion to reduce the discount rate from 7% to 6.75 as of July 1, 2022?
I so moved.
It's Kevin.
Okay.
I heard Jim first.
Okay.
Okay, give it Kevin. To Kevin first, I'll second. How's that? I've been doing all too right. much.
Kevin made the motion, Jim seconded it. All right, any discussion? Call the vote, please.
Mark?
Aye.
Kevin?
Aye.
Jim?
Aye.
Jorge? I think Jorge's frozen.
I believe I'm back in. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I yes. can hear you now.
My vote is yes.
Jeff?
Aye.
Elsa?
Aye.
Motion passes 6-0.
Okay. Finally, we are talking about shortening the amortization period from 20 years to 15 years. Is there a as it commencing as of July 1, 2022. Is there a motion to approve that?
Well, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is for Dana. What would be the financial effect on the city's required cash contribution if we go from 20 to 15?
Well, barring serious adverse experience, there wouldn't be any. It would be if there was adverse experience, you know, if you had a major market correction without any recovery, then it could be an increase. And so, you know, we've looked at some of those scenarios, and it does take quite a bit for the 15 years to kick in above the 27 and a half, but it can happen.
And we would have the ability, or some board in the future would have the ability to adjust for that, correct?
Yes.
This is not a unamendable constitutional change. Okay. Do we have a motion to approve the shortening the period from 20 years to 15 years effective July 1, 2022?
So moved. This is Jorge.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Thanks. All right. Any discussion?
Yeah, this is Kevin. We've already taken two very strong steps to regard our funding policy, one being closing the plan, and then to and that'll make us more consistent with the majority of public plans, which we've seen from a representative list from our actuary. We've also taken the step to drop the discount rate from 7% to 6.75%, which, at least from the representative list we saw from the actuary, the median was 7%. So we were at the median, now we're below the median. So I think those two steps are sufficient. I see no need to drop to a 15-year closed amortization period.
This is Jim. I'm in agreement with Kevin. I think we need to give the city manager as much flexibility as we can while still taking advantage of the economic conditions. And I think we've gone 2/3 of the way there. I really would hold off on shortening the period.
And honestly, I can't say I'm in disagreement with that statement. You know, I have to throw it out there as a best practice. But I think, you know, if you walk away from today with a 20-year closed 6.75, I can't possibly be unhappy with that. I mean, would 15-year be stronger? Of course. But I can't honestly say, like, you must do 15. So, I mean, I know, again, I probably should say you must do 15, but I cannot get there. So I'm not in disagreement with those statements.
All right. Any additional discussion? Art, would you call the vote, please?
Art.
Nay.
Kevin.
Nay.
Jim.
No.
Jorge.
Nay.
Jeff.
Nay.
Elsa.
No.
Motion fails.
Thank you. Again, Dana, thanks so much to you and your team for all you've done for us. We really do appreciate it. You both substantively got us onto a good solid path, taking advantage of good times, but you made it relatively easy for us in terms of the process and the sharing of information and explanations. We really appreciate that. This could have been way more difficult. So thank you.
I'm glad to have been a part of it. I'm proud of the outcome, and I think this is a great path forward for the plan. So thank you for having me.
You're certainly welcome to stay, but that's totally your call.
No, that's okay. I'll probably get on out of here, but thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Before Dana leaves, Dana left. I was going to, Dana's still here?
Yeah.
No. I assume we're done with this subject for the time being, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Maybe I excused her too soon. Okay. Next item on the agenda is an update on the fiscal year 2023 budget preparation. Art?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, as you know, one of the duties of the board is to review and adopt the next fiscal year's budget. Per the code and per the board rules and regulations. What I do want to share with the board today, while I don't have a budget for 23 to show you just yet, the city manager is taking a different approach with the budget preparations this year. And we are, the method, as I understand it, is they are going to approve the 2023 budgets as they were in 2022, with any known increases of escalation built into those budgets. So the TSRS budget will remain the same as it is this fiscal year, with the one exception being the half person that was to be charged TSRS that I explained at the during the budget cycle in preparation to last fiscal year. I don't know if that got built into the budget in 23. And moreover, I have not been authorized to fill that position, so it remains vacant as of today. I have resubmitted for that position to be, and let me remind the board, it is a full-time position which will be shared between TSRS and the self-insurance trust fund, which is the other I manage. And so I do expect that to be funded in 2023. But when I present the budget numbers to you next month, know that they won't look drastically different from what they do now. And the only change will be probably in that personnel line item to account for any cost of living adjustments the city is providing to our active employee population, and whatever we arrive at from a healthcare cost perspective. Right now, that is anticipated to be about 10% increase in healthcare costs. And I don't know what the cost share will be between the city and the employee just yet, but we are working to lower that overall percentage. But when I bring you the numbers next month, that's what you'll see. So we are taking a bit of a different approach for the fiscal year 23 budget. And I wanted to just make the board aware, so that when we see this and we move to approve this budget in April, it looks, the reason it looks very similar to what we're doing now is that was the direction from the city manager. So I will be bringing you numbers next month in a format that it should be familiar to those of you who've seen the presentation.
This is, Art, this is department-wide for the city, this practice?
It, Yeah, this is being taken with all general fund, all departments, regardless of the fund.
Okay. Does make the budgeting process easy, doesn't it?
It does for me.
Yeah, here's your budget. Yeah, okay. All right, any questions about the budgeting process or preparations, such as they are? All right, next item on the agenda is the a discussion of the disability code language, the disability application, and the process. This is an item that is on the agenda, largely driven by our experiences last month, but we certainly don't want to suggest that we're looking at changes simply because we had two unusual cases that happened to happen in one month. But I think that both cases identified some potential issues with the process, and Art and I and Cassie thought that it made sense to use those situations as an opportunity to take a look and see if we're doing this as well as we can. So that's the purpose. Art?
Yeah, thank you, Mark, members of the board. I want to provide a little context because I think it was in 2019 for those new board members. Well, we had Dr. Krasner in to have a presentation at the retreat. And it was a far reaching conversation about the application, about the process, about the code language. And at that time, we were to come back with disability language and application such that the policy was to match the code language. And for one reason or another, this fell off my plate. And we came back last month with the two disability applications. And it occurred to me from the dialogue that we had in and out of executive session that maybe we ought to look at this a little more closely and really align those two practices. And so and it's not like, to Mark's point, it wasn't realistic. It wasn't out of those two cases in particular. But what I'm trying to do is make sure that it's easier for the board to understand what it means, what the code language means to be disabled from a total and permanent perspective, and how our process either align or doesn't align with that code language, and where there are gray areas in either the code or the process. And I know there's been some questions about reasonable accommodation. Is the applicant able to do any job within the city, or is it the job that applicant is currently in? And so my goal with this item is really to have a broad discussion and figure out what is the best way to make it easier on the board and really easier on the applicant to understand what decisions the board is about to make with their application and what the board is considering in the disability application packet and process. So that's my goal. That's the intent coming out of the meeting. And I suspect we'll spend a little bit of time here. And I've asked Don and Pete really to, because they deal with the day-to-day process of the application, the applicant, so I've asked them to sort of provide us with an overview of that process from the applicant's initial application through the time it gets to the board. So once we have an understanding of that process, we can look at the code language, because there's a couple of things in the code language that refer to total and permanent. And from where I sit, total and permanent disability means you can't do any job anywhere at all. And I don't know if that is necessarily the interpretation of the board as we're looking at these applications. especially as it relates to reasonable accommodation and if the applicant did in fact go through the accommodation process. And honestly, whether that even really matters in the process. So I'll pause here and ask Cassie to chime in as necessary, and then I'll turn it over to Pete and Don to walk you through.
Go ahead. The process. All right, let me jump in before you, Cassie, for just a second and remind everybody that we did have two recent executive sessions last month. In this discussion, we all need to be careful not to use as examples or comment on what was discussed last month in executive sessions. And we shouldn't use people's names, et cetera, et cetera. Just be sensitive to those issues, and I'm sure everybody will, but it's easy to slip. Go ahead, Cassie. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. That's a good reminder. I just want to give a little bit of background from my perspective. I was new to the system in 2009, but I was part of the language changes that included the updated definition of disability. And at the time, we had a definition in the code that said someone was disabled if they can no longer perform the essential duties of their position with the city. And as an intentional cost-saving measure, the city converted to this total and permanent disability definition. The thought being that system resources need to be protected and preserved and would be best directed to the people who can no longer work in any capacity because of a disability that arose when they were with the city. And so the total and permanent standard at the time was intended to address people who can't perform anything that would result in their own reasonable support. So we do have all of these extraneous issues that are important to discuss because people go through an accommodation process. They work with HR. We look at whether there's a potential other job at the city. And under a true total and permanent disability standard, accommodations wouldn't matter. Other jobs wouldn't matter because the person from a medical perspective can't work in any capacity. And so what we need to decide as the board is that the standard that continues to be appropriate, and how do we apply that in the context of the IMEs that we get from Dr. Krasner and the city's general process for people who go out on leave due to medical concerns. So the only other factor I want you to keep in mind is that the old code language specifically said that the disabling condition had to occur while the individual was employed by the city. And when the code language was rewritten, I don't think that was intentionally removed, but it no longer is written into the code. I think that it was assumed that would continue because a person has to apply for disability within a reasonable time frame from leaving employment. So they only have a year from termination. So I don't think anybody was thinking about disabilities that might arise from some other situation. But we need to clarify at the board level whether that continues to be an eligibility condition.
Are we able to make that an eligibility condition without amending the code?
Yes, I believe that can be an interpretation of the code, and we could record it in the board rules that it's preserved.
All right. Intuitively, it doesn't make a lot of sense that you could leave the city, become disabled, and come back to the city and say, pay me.
Right.
You know, that seems like doesn't make a lot of sense, but maybe people feel differently. Anyway, sorry for that.
Especially if you're able to gain employment somewhere else and the disability arose from that other employment too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Mark, do we want to hear from Pete and Don at this point? Is that what you had in mind?
That's what I had in mind, Mr. Chairman, but it's obviously the will of the board on where they want to go with this discussion. If they would like to hear from Pete and Don with respect to the process, we're happy to do that. If we want to entertain the code language first, we can certainly do that as well.
Let's get that information on the table so we've got as much as possible, and then we can proceed. And by the way, this is not an item that has to be resolved in this meeting. We can discuss and you know, get some concepts and work on this. I don't want this to turn into a 6 or 8 month process, but it certainly doesn't have to be resolved this morning. So
that's
Did Kevin, you keep popping up. Are you waiting to say something? Your purple box keeps showing.
Me?
Yeah. I don't know if it's just where your mic is, but you keep, it looks like you're ready to say something. I don't
have questions. I'm sorry. And I'm
no worries.
I'm kind of foreign this technology, but I don't have
No worries. All right. Pete and Don, do you want to jump in and tell us what we need to know?
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name's Pete, for those of you who don't recognize me. And I'd be happy to give you a brief rundown. I'll try to keep it about 5 minutes, just because, well, because it's a bunch of policies. So I'm going to share my screen now so you can see exactly what we have. And Don, I trust you to either raise your hand or interrupt me if I get off track or say something which sounds inaccurate in your experience. So hopefully you all are now able to see the screen, which now shows that we have in front of us the Tucson Supplemental Retirement System Disability Retirement Process and Application. So this is actually the form which we distribute to individuals who are interested in pursuing a disability application with the board. And as I'll be happy to distribute this to anybody who wants it. This is a blank one. You can see it. You can mark it up, whatever you'd like. But I'd like to show it to you because it provides a nice overview of what we recommend compared to what we require. And so we have recommendations up here, which are investigate your ability to get short-term disability benefits, long-term disability benefits, Social Security disability benefits. And we note that those are all independent actions of pursuing disability pension benefits. In addition, we strongly recommend that you discuss with your supervisor, we call it the employer, what kind of accommodations can be reached for coming back to work before you start down the path of declaring permanent and total disability. Once we have provided that information, we trust that individuals will make knowledgeable and useful decisions for themselves about what they're going to pursue. Frequently, we're dealing with individuals who will pursue all of the options listed above. And as they go through that process, you know, maybe accommodation doesn't work because there is no way to accommodate a total and permanent disability. But they're also going to be pursuing short-term disability or long-term disability and Social Security disability at the same time they're pursuing the TSRS pension. We then require all the information which we collect, collate, and distribute to the board for its review in making a determination. And so we ask that we note that there are the board's physician and that the individual will have some time to prepare themselves to come before the board. And then we go right into tell us about yourself. Tell us what happened. What's the problem? Who is your individual physician? And so we're collecting their medical information from their own physician. And then authorization to share medical records. And we go straight to Dr. Krasner. We also collect information from the supervisor to make sure that we have a holistic view of whether or not it appears that this individual can or cannot complete the duties of their current job. And the way that I say that is very specific. And it kind of relates back to the presentation that Dr. Krasner gave to the board a couple of years ago, where he was very clear, it is beyond the scope of his report to determine any and all disabilities. So he flat out stated it is beyond the scope of his office in order to say this person cannot do any gainful employment at the city, primarily because he doesn't know what jobs are available at the city, nor does he know what skills, abilities, and knowledge the individual has. And those may or may those skills, knowledge, and abilities can change over time. So there are very few conditions which would be so permanent and totally disabling that you could categorically say cannot ever do work. An individual who loses the use of a limb or two limbs may not be able to fully function in the position which requires physical activity, but may be very capable if they decide to go back to school and become a lawyer. Just no way to know that up ahead of time. So these are problems which the board has already faced and already thought about. I'm just trying to remind you of what's happened in the past. And so we do compare the position which is required. We send the current job description and job duty requirements to Dr. Krasner for his evaluation. And that's what he uses in order to write his medical report. All that information is then packaged, distributed to the board for its review. And then there's a board meeting where the individual is invited to present any additional information or any new information which may not have made it into the packet and present themselves to the board for a decision. I tried to keep that compact, keep that short and sweet so you guys would get the information without a lot of extras. And I am happy to answer any questions anyone might have.
Any questions for Pete?
Yeah, Pete, in amassing the information, do you also make us aware consistently of the any differences between any changes over time in the job qualifications where someone might be qualified before and not now or vice versa?
No. So we do not attempt to monitor the change in job requirements that occurs over time in relation to any individual who has either submitted for a disability application or been approved for a disability application.
Is there anything that would prohibit us from forcing the requirements to be consistent with the current definitions rather than in the past? I don't want us to get into a situation where they've changed appreciably. What will it take to allow us to be consistent?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay. Without mentioning names and whatnot, but if we have are presented a situation where someone is qualified now, but unqualified based on a previous job description. Someone comes back to us after an absence and applies, and we have to look at what the former qualifications are for the job versus the current ones.
So the only time that the board reconsiders cases is when a case represents itself. And that can happen for a couple of reasons. One is there was an initial denial and the individual has new information they want to present. The second would be because an individual the board has determined that it wishes to obtain an updated medical examination, which is perfectly within the board's purview on any individual case. the what we do as a staff is we have an annual certification process where we touch each and every individual who is receiving a disability payment and ask them what the status of their condition is, whether or not there's been any improvement. And we ask them, excuse me, for verification of any earned income. So if they are earning income, we're curious about what the source of that income is and whether that affects their payments. If their condition has or has not improved, also would bring about this would be a case which we may want to bring back to the board to see if you want a medical recertification. So we monitor that and we present you with any information which arises out of that annual audit process, but we do not attempt to match a change in job qualifications or job descriptions from the past to a currently disabled, still stating that they are disabled individual, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Thanks, Pete.
Okay. Art and then Jorge.
Yeah, I think that's a good question, Jim. And I want to pose a question to the board. And in terms of how we think about this, right? Should the board's ultimate role in this is to determine whether the applicant is totally and permanently disabled, right? That's my understanding of the board's role. And whether the applicant has met the qualifications as outlined in the code. To the extent that we don't want to touch the code, and I'm not saying that we do or we don't, but our application, right, should not our application match that language or the intent of the language? What I'm saying is, would we need to look at revising our application process such that the information contained within the application only allows the or only provides the board with the information necessary to determine a total and permanent disability? Because I think we muddy the waters when we're talking about reasonable accommodation, other job descriptions, and it makes the board's job a little more difficult in assessing the applicant's qualifications for disability. And I think that's a question broadly, right? I'm not looking for an answer now, but I think it's one the board should consider as we're talking about this entire process moving forward.
All right, Jorge, then Jeff, then Jim. Jorge, you got to turn your mic off or turn your mic on. There you go.
Sorry about that. Here we go. So my question is more of a my understanding. So a disability disability retirement application really is to fill the gap between, it's for an individual who may find himself or herself unable to work before they reach retirement eligibility, correct?
Yes.
Is that a yes?
Yes.
Yes. So the disability, okay, when it's approved, it is a monthly lifetime guaranteed payment, just like you would get as a retiree. Mm-hmm. And it does not get discounted for early retirement. Okay. And it allows for it, the special provisions of disability allow for the applicant to become qualified for that where they otherwise wouldn't. Normally, we have the 80 or 85 points or the normal retirement age.
Okay. So if the individual gets approved for disability retirement, there's no adjustment. I mean that's a permanent determination. There's no adjustment once that person reaches that milestone, whether it be age or.
Unless they are ages, right?
There is one small adjustment. Okay. So once an individual who is receiving a disability benefit reaches normal retirement age, we stop asking them to certify that they're continued to be disabled.
Okay.
Because now they are qualified to receive their pension benefit regardless.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Their calculation, correct me if I'm wrong, Pete, is based upon the years of service and their salary up to the time that they apply for a disability application.
That's correct. We use the same calculation and formula, no additional adjustments, either positive or negative.
Jeff, I think you were next, Jeff.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So two questions. That annual recertification that you had described, Pete, is there any documentation requested or any sort of proof associated with that when we're asking them, hey, what's your current condition and have you generated any other income?
So the requirement for the disclosure of their condition is simply a statement. So they attest that their condition has improved or not. We don't require any additional documentation on that. But for the earned income, we do. So we always require documentation on earned income. We do not require additional information on their medical unless we have a reason to follow up.
What would be an example of a reason to follow up just for my own education?
Earned income.
Okay. But if they answered in the affirmative, yeah, I've gotten better. We don't dig beyond that. I mean, even if they say yes, my condition has improved, they still retain that status nonetheless.
No. So if they say yes, I'm able to work, we say thank you. Okay. Glad that your condition has improved, and we will be turning off your disability pension benefit because you are no longer permanently and totally disabled.
Okay. Got it.
Then so, we would inform the board, but we wouldn't ask for the board to take any action in that case because they have self-certified that they are no longer in that program.
So, and I might be getting the cart before the horse or misunderstanding maybe the root of some of this conversation. So feel free to bring me back in line if I go down a rabbit hole here, guys. So one of the things that I'm seeing that we need to make a decision on at some point is the fundamental nature between whether or not we feel the language should rule somebody as disabled in their current position versus any available position within the city. And from listening to Pete's presentation, I certainly understand where Dr. Krasner is coming from in saying that, you know, he can't determine once and for all whether somebody is able to function in any position ever again. I mean, that's pretty sweeping, but that's exactly what we're being asked to try to determine. Does anybody have any input in or knowledge of how other entities go about this and if there exists any, for lack of a better phrase, best practices surrounding this type of issue? I mean, we can't be unique in the only body struggling with this issue.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, can I respond to Jeff?
Mark froze.
Okay. I think one of the things that we have incorporated into the policy is we've given the board the ability to rely on a Social Security determination about disability, because Social Security is doing the same thing. They're making determinations on partial or total disability. So if a member has a Social Security determination, the board has the authority to basically rely on that determination. That's one factor. And then going back to Art's point earlier about the additional information that's given to the board in terms of accommodation and potential other jobs in the city, that information originally was continued to the board because it gives a little bit more of the picture beyond what Dr. Krasner can tell us. So Dr. Krasner can tell us that a person can't do their current job. And he may be able to go a little bit beyond that if there are functional restrictions that would affect a lot of jobs. But he can't, as you said, give the blanket total disability. But if you pair Dr. Krasner's records with the treating physician's records, with information on the accommodation process, whether the employee had conferred with the city about any other job opportunities, then you get a little bit more of the whole picture. You know, for example, if the employee says they could transfer to another job at a comparable pay level, but they wouldn't be willing to transfer to a position that would pay less, then there's some indication from the employee that they can work. And that's relevant.
Sorry, I got lost. I've got computer problems. Dawn?
I just wanted to piggyback on what Cassie just said. OHL does not tell us when someone has turned down a position. They only tell us whether or not they have sought accommodation.
Kevin or Jim, I'm not sure who was next.
I think I had it, Jim, and then Kevin.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, okay. Kathy has answered my question that I was about to pose, and just making a commentary on the accommodation process. Yeah, this doesn't muddy the water for me. If anything, it gives me an indication of the ability of the organization of COT to do everything possible to make sure that the employee is getting a fair shake in this process. So I'm in favor of keeping that.
Kevin?
Yeah, I just kind of following up with what Jeff was talking about. I guess if Dr. Krasner, and it's a difficult role that we're in, but if Dr. Krasner can't determine, because of lack of information, not complete information, if they can't determine permanent and total disability, I then question, and of course we often get the person's personal physician that submits something, and they will say the person is permanently disabled. I mean, even when they make that statement, it's always kind of a little hard to, how can they reach that conclusion? I mean, do they have that much more information about this patient than Krasner does? They probably do have more information, but do they really have enough information to reach that conclusion? So then I was going to just say is, well, if those guys can't figure it out, how are we supposed to figure it out? And I understand Cassie's point that, well, you know, we've got better assessment. Are there other jobs they might be able to do? And that the, you know, Social Security must have some criteria to figure it out. But I guess it ultimately lands back as the burden of the employee that's trying to get this. They really have to demonstrate that they can't do anything, and the burden is on them. But it puts us in a tough spot.
Okay. Elsa, and then I'm going to jump in. Go ahead. Sure.
And I also just want to comment that I think the big picture going through the ADA process does help guide whether somebody is, you know, totally disabled or not. But going back to a point that Don indicated, that, you know, we don't receive information from OHL when individuals decline to go through that process, I think that shouldn't be incorporated into the picture that we get as well, because that is a tool for employees to seek to continue employment. And if there's a reason that they're declining it, then that's something I think that the board should know as well.
Okay. Let me just make a few observations. One, from experience, when I started practicing law 40 years ago, one of my two employers spent a fair amount of time doing Social Security disability appeals, and experience back then, and it's been confirmed by employees and other lawyers I know, is that Social Security begins its process by saying no in virtually every case, and really does make it pretty difficult. So I'm not sure that that's a terribly good measure of whether somebody is or isn't totally and permanently disabled. This discussion tells me that for those of us who are involved with this process, at least from time to time, none of this is terribly clear. And I can only imagine how this must be for an employee who's facing a crisis in their life and trying to figure it out. And that's with the belief that folks like Pete and Don are probably doing everything they can in the process to help people understand it and get through it. But it's a mess. Situations where somebody says, yeah, I can still do the job, but it's an 8-hour shift and I can do it for 2 or 3 or 4. I don't know what that means in terms of total and permanent disability. Seems like unless there's the ability to get a 2-hour-a-day job, which means you're only partially disabled, I don't know how that works. I don't know. I guess my question for you, Cassie, is do we have a code and a system? And you may not know the answer. Do we have a code and a system that's pretty similar to what other municipalities are using?
I think that it's all across the board. So our old standard, where you an employee had to be determined to be unable to perform their current position, that was a very common standard 20, 30 years ago. And as pension plans have constricted to preserve assets, the total and permanent is becoming more common. And of course, you know, in the public safety sector, where these plans are still the go-to benefit plan, obviously they've got all kinds of variations of disability that we don't get into, like line of duty. I think that I understand all of the issues that the board is bringing up, and that's why we wanted to have this conversation. We do right now have code language that is total and permanent. So as long as that language remains the standard, the board has to do its best to make that determination. And as Elsa mentioned, if we can get additional information to the board to help complete that picture, I think that's helpful, and that's one of the things we want to take from this conversation. On the Social Security determinations, I agree with the chairman's comments, and we've talked before about the fact that 99% of our applicants aren't going to have time to get a determination, even their initial denial, within the city's disability process timeline. So when we do receive a Social Security determination, that means Social Security acted quickly and it was not a fight to get that determination. So let's look carefully at that because they saw something there. But that's the exception, not the norm.
Okay. Kevin?
I'm sorry, I don't have any further questions.
Okay. I do have one other observation, and it's on topic, but less core to the subject we've been discussing. Dr. Krasner represents us when he's dealing with applicants, I believe, in their minds. Mm-hmm. He's the man in the same way that we're the man, and that's with a capital T and a capital M. You know, the one who's going to say yes or no. And I don't want to say that an applicant's observations are necessarily accurate or not, but I want to be sure that when applicants are presenting themselves, they believe at our level, and I think they do because I think we make sure of that, but at every level in the process, including Dr. Krasner, that folks feel like they're getting a fair shake, they're getting attention, they're getting time, and they're getting an opportunity to be heard and seen. And I heard something last month that gave me some pause there. So I just think we want to keep that issue in mind because he is somebody who is functioning as our expert eyes and ears. And I don't want to hear people saying, you know, I got 3 minutes with him. Having just violated my exposition about getting too specific. I don't think that can be tied to anything, but it does concern me. And again, it may be completely a misrepresentation of what happened, but it's the kind of thing that concerns me. And I would expect everybody wants to be sure that people who go to see him are getting a fair shake. Art?
Yeah, if I could bring this back, it would help me to understand, does the board struggle more with the code language or the process, right? And let me be clear, I have my own views on this. I'm just not expressing them because I'm not a voting member of this board. To help the board get to where we need to get, I need to understand if it's more on the language in the code or the application of the code in the process that we currently have. And until we define that concern or that issue, because if you guys are satisfied with the process that we go through and want to enhance the information that we send to the board, and that will help you identify the code language, okay, then that tells me we need to beef up the process and the application. But if you're not clear on what total and permanent is in the code, then the application doesn't really even matter. It's the code language that we need to clear up to make it easier for the board to be able to, as easily as possible, discern whether the applicant is totally and permanently disabled, right? So if I could just get a straw poll of whether where the concern is.
Okay. Let's, Jim, hang on for just a second. Let's do a show of hands so we move this along. How many people feel like the code language is okay and we've got process issues? Nobody.
So
how many people feel like, I'm sorry.
Not to overcomplicate it, but I'm having a hard time drawing a distinction. I mean, they're both kind of the same thing in my mind. The code language is the policy that supports the application and gives us the context that we review the application in. They're interconnected. So if we understand what our obligation is surrounding the code language, and if we're in clear agreement of what that is, then it is partly the process and the information that we collect behind it.
I'm comfortable with the interpretation and the language of total and permanent. I think the process needs a little bit more defining. I think so. I would be interested in looking one at the application, but also the efforts done around accommodation, because I think that would tell a lot whether a person does meet that criteria or not.
I'm not at all comfortable with the language in the code. When I heard Art say a little while ago, the language in the code or its intent, lawyers worry a lot about trying to figure out what intent is in a situation. And if we've got a process that has language and we need to try and figure out what that language means, it immediately makes me wonder if we couldn't have clearer language in the code. These are big deal issues for people. And I, for one, am sitting here not completely clear if total and permanent disability means you can't do any job at all. You can't do any job that the city of Tucson offers at all, or you can't do a job that you are otherwise qualified for at that point in time that may or may not be available at the city. That's not clear to me as I sit here today. And I'm speaking, I apologize for my stories, but when I was a young lawyer, I bought own occupation disability insurance, and it was trial lawyer. I didn't try very many cases, but my understanding of that policy was if I got some kind of a condition that said I could not do litigation and go to trial, I could get disability benefits. And I spent about 20 years trying to figure out how I could make that work for me. never got there. And I'm now within, I think, 4 months of not paying premiums anymore because the policy times out at age 65. But, I don't know what that all means. And I think the cases last month gave us some reason to have doubt about what that means. Cassie and then Jim.
Yeah, I wanted to just take a step back too on the code language issue, because we do talk about the code standard being total and permanent disability, but that's not all we have in the code. We have a little bit more than that. And it does say that it's the inability to engage in any substantial gainful activity with the city. That with the city provision is tough. So inability to engage in any substantial gainful activity with the city by reason of any medically determinable physical or mental impairment that can be expected to result in death or continue for a long and indefinite duration. So we do need to refer to that standard when the board has to make these decisions. So does the evidence show us, first off, that the condition is expected to continue for the person's foreseeable lifespan? Or is it something that's likely to improve with future medical treatment?
Can I stop you for 1 second and just ask, is this standard in addition to total and permanent disability so that it's one or the other? Or is this what we have interpreted to mean total and permanent disability?
This is the definition of total and permanent disability in the code.
Okay. All right. Keep going. Thanks.
We also would look at this inability to engage in any substantial gainful activity with the city. Now, I think that clause with the city confuses things. Most total and permanent disability standards do say it's an inability to engage in any substantial gainful activity. You can't support yourself. But this with the city is an additional wrinkle. And my recollection at the time was that language was included to give reference to a broad array of different types of jobs. I don't recall it being included as a standard of, is there a job available today at the city? Because again, that's somewhat inconsistent with the idea that somebody can't work anymore to worry about what jobs are open. So
to be clear on that issue, if there is a position that you could fill with the city despite your disability, you would not be totally and permanently disabled, even though that position might not be open.
Yeah.
Okay. Conceivably, you could have somebody for whom there's really only one job at the city, in theory. There's only one position at the city that their particular condition would allow them to fill. And we could have a 25-year-old in that position who loves his or her job, but you're not disabled because you could do that job if that person ever quit or died.
Yeah, and that goes back to the idea of where system resources should be directed. So if there is a job that a person can theoretically perform with their condition, then should they have disability pension support from the system until retirement age, or should they go and do that type of job?
Okay. All right. Cassie, were you, I interrupted 3 times. I apologize. Are you?
I'm good for now. Thanks.
Okay. Jim?
Yeah, I wanted to extend Jeff's thinking one or two thoughts further down the road. It seems to me, I'm looking back at my administrative experience in both the private and public sector, and invariably, when we had broken processes, that led us back to the root causes of them, and most of it happened to be in poorly defined policies. And so it seems to me either poorly defined or ambiguous. And it seems to me all routes go back to the city code for me. Mark, to answer your question, I'm not terribly worried about the policy right now, but I am concerned about the code, and perhaps it could be clarified a bit more.
Well, I think Cassie's exposition, and again, in theory, we would all have all of this information available, but we're all part-timers. So thank you for providing that clarity. I think that provides more clarity than I thought there was when I heard, you have to be totally and permanently disabled, full stop, because the definition does start to get us closer to a meaningful standard. Go ahead.
Sorry, I did want to make one other point that in applications years ago, nothing recent, I do remember the board receiving much more information from treating physicians. And I don't know if that's just up to the individual applicant, but I do recall some packets that were inches thick. And it's like, oh, I'm not a doctor. How do I get through all this? But when you do read the doctor's summary letters that often go with those reports, you can in those cases get a better feel for how the member's really living their life. So I don't know on the process side, if we can do something to encourage more disclosure from treating physicians so that we have information beyond Krasner's evaluation. But I see that in some of the applications, we're not getting much from those physicians.
We deal with all day long. We do protective proceedings in my office, and the paucity of information from physicians and healthcare providers is next to dealing with financial institutions. It's our biggest problem in our office. And it's just, I think it's a function of a healthcare system where nobody has time and nobody wants to interface very much with the healthcare system, with the legal system. So I think, getting anything out of anybody is really challenging. That's my sense. I don't know if anybody has a different perspective. But Jim, you've had your hand up for a while. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm done.
Oh, your hand's still up. Thank you. Okay. Any other topics that haven't popped up? I had the issue I mentioned a few minutes ago. Is there anything else related to this subject that's on anybody's mind? This would be a good time to get it out there before we talk about next steps. Pete, do you have a sense that let me ask this. How many disability applications are you seeing? And I guess it's not very many, because we don't see very many, and we see all of them, right?
You see all the ones which are completed, yes.
Okay.
We do receive more inquiries and more questions about, well, what about disability? And so, we share information with people, and it's probably 50% or more of those inquiries don't result in a completed application.
Okay.
Yeah, if you include.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, if you include all those inquiries, even just the phone calls of, I really got hurt at work today, I need disability, that number drops again, because, people think that there's this.
What's your sense of the satisfaction level from people you're dealing with? Is there a high degree of frustration and annoyance, or do people feel pretty good about their opportunities and they back off when they realize that they probably just don't qualify?
I deal with individuals, and individuals who communicate with me tend to have a problem. Let me say it that way. I hear people complain. I hear people's complaints. I do not hear people talking about, That was a very difficult but useful and fair process. Thank you for helping me through. I don't get those responses.
Okay.
I get, oh, why are you making me do this? Oh, this is so frustrating.
Okay.
Oh, this was unfair for, I get the litany of problems. I don't get a lot of satisfied customers.
Fair enough. Probably a bad question. Sorry. All right.
It's biased. My information is biased.
Yeah. Well, thank you for what you're doing. Any other issues that pop up within this broad realm of disability benefits? Okay. Art, do you have, or Cassie, do you, either of, or both of you have a sense for what we ought to be doing next in terms of, and it may be that we've had our discussion and we're done. That's certainly a possibility, but what's the sense? You all are more expert on this than any of us, except Pete.
Mr. Chairman, my sense is the board is, based on the comments that I've heard, the board is sort of torn on the issue. And some what I've heard is some individuals would prefer that we look at the code and clarify the code. Others would prefer that we look at the process. And without a clear distinction between without a clear majority, I'm sort of stuck trying to figure out how to help the board navigate this process. The other option is to do nothing and continue to look at this on a case-by-case basis. And I can tell you with some confidence, you're going to see another one next month. And so this issue is you know, not going to go away, at least in the near term. And my goal, as I said at the outset, is really try and help the board either better understand the process that an applicant goes through so that you're informed from A to Z, or help you clear up what is not clear so that we can I can make your jobs as a board easier when we do get these applications.
Or go ahead, Cassie.
Yeah, I was just going to, I do hear the struggles that the board's having, and I completely understand them with the framework that you're given. I would think that my takeaways from today would be that within the current code framework, we need to do a better job with each application packet of laying out the rules that we do have for the board. So maybe with each application that goes to the board, we recite the definition from the code of total and permanent. We give you whatever framework we do have in writing that you can rely on. And as Pete and Dawn are developing the packet with the member, I would encourage them to reiterate to the employee that this is a high, high standard and that they need to give us everything they can that speaks to whether they can do any work. And maybe they're already doing that. Maybe it is just difficult to pull this information together. But I do feel like sometimes when we speak with the applicant, they don't understand the standard.
Art, do you have a, is there a, either a listserv or a group of people like you around the country who are running these programs in municipalities of some size?
I'm sure there are. But I don't have a listserv. I know
one of those.
Okay. I could reach out to, you know, there's obviously only three or four in Arizona that do this. It's PSPRS. And as Cassie mentioned, their list of disabilities is quite lengthier than what we're examining here. ASRS probably. What's that?
What about NARECA? Are you in that? The National Association of Retirement Administrators? Okay. I'll take a look at their website.
ASRS
and COPRS, the City of Phoenix Retirement System, are the only systems that I'm aware of in the city that are municipal systems in the state that operate pension plans that would have to make these types of decisions. So I can certainly reach out to ASRS and understand their standard as well as COPRS.
Yeah, it seems to me that we've invested an hour now in this subject, and I think jump in if you all think I'm wrong, but I think the discussion reflects the fact that we've all got at least some level of concern about how we're doing this and how well we're doing it. And it certainly makes sense to me that we may want to look at how others are doing it. And it may be that the answer is, yeah, this is our hardest thing. And, you know, we do the best we can and nobody's got a great answer for it. But Cassie, if you've got any resources that you can look at, that would make some sense too. And maybe we can just put this on either next month or the month after. Maybe awkward if we have a disability matter and we're discussing this at the same time. That feels a little weird to me. But
Mr. Chairman, yeah. I might suggest is give me some time to go back.
Okay.
And do a little research with ASRS and COPRS, combined with what Cassie's able to pull from the National Association of Retirement Administrator, NASRA, I think it is what it's called. Mm-hmm. And we'll put this on a future agenda item. Trust that it won't be next month.
Okay.
But you will have a disability application again next month. So I think we can continue the conversation based upon the direction that I've received today, and I'll bring back more information at a future meeting.
Okay, and I didn't mean to be front loading this to the exclusion of other things you all are busy with. So don't when you have the information and you've got time to pull it together, and we've got a meeting where we can devote some time to it. This was a good meeting to have this discussion at, because we really didn't have much else going on.
I want to keep it fresh. I want to keep it top of mind, right? Because if we go 6 months without picking it up, we're not going to remember what the concerns were. So,
but I'll continue. May or June is not a big deal, I don't think. All right. I think that completes the agenda. Does anybody have any other items that we need to discuss? Or did I miss anything?
No, Mr. Chairman, that covers it.
Okay. We all ready to adjourn? All right, we will see you. Art, I guess one other question, and that is, and I know this because the courts are starting to reopen. Is there any sense for when we start meeting again in person? Is this the way we will go forward, even though we may be able to meet in person? Anything going on that front?
You know, Mr. Chairman, the city has relaxed its mask mandate here at City Hall. There's a few of us administrators that have been asked to come back full time or near full time. The county is relaxing their mask mandates and standards, but as yet, I've not heard anything about a return to work. If I had to guess, the city manager's direction is going to leave it up to the directors to figure out when we can come back. As it relates to boards and commissions, my thought there is once mayor and council comes back in person, they'll probably relax those standards and we'll come back in person. But I've not given a time. I've not been given a timeline on that.
Mention of it, Art. For mayor and council, and they're looking at, I believe, next month, as soon as next month.
Okay. Oh, okay. So one, you know, the city clerk's office really is the one who needs to tell me that we can come back and meet in person. And once that's done, we'll transition back to in-person meetings. And I suspect that there will be a provision in the mayor and council ordinances that are going to provide the ability to meet electronically, because I can't see this as an option moving forward.
Okay. All right. Let's all say goodbye so Art can get to his 10 o'clock. He didn't think we'd be talking at 10, and We're not going to be talking at 10, but pretty close. All right. Thank you all for a good meeting. We appreciate your attendance and participation. Take care.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Bye.
Thank you all.